So those of you who have Facebook, you know that the title of this sermon is Sex. I was hoping for hundreds of people to come based on that titillating title. The truth is, this is going to be about the bad kind of sex, not the good kind of sex. You'll notice, you may notice, there's a good kind, is that what you just said? It's already embarrassing. So you'll notice, you may have noticed, certain, as we've talked about in the past weeks, certain fractures and divisions have become more evident in our society, certain terms and public discourse that has been prohibited or circumscribed for decades now seems to have come back. Certain words, like the B word, were present at political rallies, words that we didn't hear or would not hear or ideally should not hear, ought not hear in public, return to public discourse, maybe catalyzed by or by the appearance of the first major party female candidate and the difficulty many people have, sometimes by theological background, sometimes by personal instinct, to see certain people at the top of a public hierarchy, to invert or subvert previous senses of societal norms. Maybe that's part of it. But this week's parasha also concerns itself or addresses a previous societal norm of women in a very precarious position. And through that, through analyzing the parasha and the way women are relegated to non-speaking parts for the most part, we might consider how we would move forward to repair ruptured relationships between the genders, between the sexes, and how we might move forward, what the ideal relationships are among all of God's creatures. So we are going to talk about some things that Anita Diamant's book, The Red Tent, notwithstanding, are kind of ugly. I think I had a problem with her book. For those of you who know it, it's a retelling of Dina's story, which largely occurs in this week's parasha. And it's not a whitewashing, but it implies a lot of positivity in the things that happened to Dina. It's not a bad book, but I don't think that's what the Torah is describing. But first, a different story, a different part of the parasha, a little bit later, where Reuven, one of our ancestors, one of our firstborn ancestors, early-born ancestors, cohabits with Bilhah, his father's concubine. And later, Jacob will curse him and his tribe for having done this. And our sages, some centuries later, were so uncomfortable with this episode, which is somewhere between sexual assault and somewhere between incest, that they insisted on whitewashing Reuven's facts here, much as they do with David and Bathsheba. They excuse it and try to rewrite the story so it doesn't appear so vulgar. And it says in the Torah that the sons of Jacob were 12, and our sages infer from that that they were all righteous. Therefore, when it says he lay with Bilhah, our sages say in Talmud, it just means he scooched the bed over. Maybe he wanted to clean underneath it. You know, we have a couple of friends and I at the gym have a game where we listen to songs. A lot of pop music is very sexualized. And we joke with each other, oh, this is just about someone going to a diner. Or this hypersexual song must be about someone and their trainer. You know, push it. They're pushing the weights. So that feels like the Talmud's goal at this moment. We live in an era, something is happening. I've been talking to a colleague about it. I've talked to congregants and friends about it, where sexually compulsive behaviors, sexual addiction, for lack of any other accurate term, is becoming much more public, both among pastors and rabbis and political candidates and persons we have known, that behaviors we might have just described as pedophilia or office place harassment or sexual peccadilloes might well be known, ought be known, as sexual addiction. And there's a large field of 12-step work and psychotherapeutic work that addresses this, and I think we should not deny it. So, in a world where such things exist, and in a world where the current status of women in our society is, once again, precarious, I think it would be fair to say, or changing, or disrupted, the somewhat unimpeded growth of women's rights and women's economic powers and social equality seems to have been disrupted and interrupted. Again, I want to look at our parsha, at the one of the signal events in Genesis of sexual violence and denigration of women. Dinah goes out among the land, and I want to say in the Torah's verse when she goes out, it may have been implying that she was doing something untoward. Women in public, even at that time, were a kind of discretion, indiscretion. There's another phrase when Jacob greets Esav. The Torah describes him greeting Esav with his sons. So our sages in Midrash say, so where was Dinah? And it says that Jacob put her in a box because he was afraid Esav might lust after her and want to marry her. That's a different question of marrying your uncle. But that attitude of keeping women circumscribed and in a corner and put in a box and voiceless is nearly as old as time. And perhaps, I think, frankly, is one of the reactions that people have. I'm not going to say everyone that didn't vote for Secretary of State Clinton voted because they were uncomfortable with a woman having a voice, but I think there was some minority of people for whom that made them uneasy. And even her style of communication, I think, made a lot of people uneasy. Because I'm generalizing here. I would put myself in the same category of people who are somewhat introverted and listen before they speak. That comes off maybe as standoffish to some. Maybe that was a part of the problem. But let's not doubt that the attitude of putting women aside and circumscribing their rights and voices and potential is nothing new under the sun. So what do we do? How do we remedy that situation? I'm going to raise a few remedies that I don't think are great remedies. So there's this scene where Shechem, the son of Hamor, who was a Hivite, the prince of the land, took her, slept with her, meaning sexually assaulted her, raped her. And then, in the very next verse, he spoke to her in words of loving kindness because he had fallen in love with her. You know, I don't know about that. I don't know if that's even possible. And it's possible. I mean, there's another law that if you assault and rape a woman that you have to marry her, which is that Numbers or Deuteronomy or Deuteronomy? You know, and then a woman is forever betrothed to someone who has violated her. Good thing that there's no teenagers or young people here. I should have checked before I... This is a rough concept. I'm feeling it as I'm giving this talk. We can't pretend that our Torah doesn't have difficult moments. We can't whitewash them. We have to go through them. That's what I'm trying to do a little bit here. So Radak, David Kimchi, it's his last Kimchi, but I like to call it Kimchi. I think his last name looks, whenever anyone writes it in English, it's Kimchi. Yeah, it was a good lunch the other day. That Korean place is great. So Radak and other sources say, you know, he saw that he caused her pain and he did his best to soothe her feelings because he wanted to marry her and he sought her consent. And he hoped that being the crown prince, and there's other midrashim, that he gave her numerous gifts and tried to assuage her pain with great promises and gifts. I'm reminded when the issues came up around President-elect being a sex addict and groping women, assaulting women without their consent, that there were people I respected, politicians I respected, who said things whose accusation of him, or whose rebuttal is not strong enough a word, but whose condemnation of him was framed in ways that weren't right. They said things, I revere women. I respect women. I have a mother. I have a sister and a daughter. which again is objectifying a person, is treating them as some people treat me. Oh, I love Israel. You know, or someone saying, oh, I know what it's like to be black. I really listen to a lot of rap music. Jay-Z is, I'm a big fan of Jay-Z. It's all, I don't know what words I have for that, but we all know what that is. That's reducing someone to a few bullet points and assuming that because we have some connection to one or three of those bullet points, we understand their difficulties and we truly can represent them and more. There's more issues with that, but that's one of them. And that's apparent in the description of that Radak gives of Hamor, the son of Shechem. He feels bad for her. Feeling bad isn't the solution. Feeling bad when we see poverty, feeling bad when we see injustice, feeling pity is not the same as a kind of compassion that motivates you to make social change, that motivates you to do something righteous, that motivates you to strive for equality and equity before the law. So there's another cute scene that I want to go to, and here the responses are slightly better, but I think aren't ideal and at best will point us in the future direction that we may want to go. So after 3 days, after the massacre at Shechem, remember they invite the Shechemites to circumcise themselves, and once they've done that, they slaughter them all. You know, I mean, I think if anyone violated my sister, I'd have quite a bit of rage and desire to harm every person involved. So it describes Shimon and Levi, Acheyak Acheidina, the brothers of Dina, as sort of dragging her out by the sword. And they took Dina out of the house of Shechem and brought her forth. So there's two midrashim about this that I think are powerful descriptions of the ways in which we relate to victimized women and victimized people in general. And we can expand this conversation, if we wanted to a broader conversation about the vulnerable in our society and how we really can have empathy, compassion, and strive for justice in their spheres. So they dragged her out, and she says, you know, I'm a broken woman. No one will marry me now. And Shimon says, I'll marry you, which is like this sweet thing that a brother would say to his sister, you know, sweet and naive thing. Which again goes back to that sort of love without a purpose. Care, but not care that's going to achieve anything meaningful for her or for the society that God and Israel commands us to strive for. The Torah is seeking a more just society. Now we have to recognize Torah existed or Torah was given or Torah was a document of a time. But I think it's fair to say, and it's not whitewashing the Torah, that it was a document that bends the arc of history towards justice. It was not perfect. It did not get us all the way there. But one of its goals, I think, to quote Martin Luther King, is to bend the arc of history towards justice. Again, not perfect. But what Shimon says, that sweet brotherly thing, is not enough. It's a sign of compassion. It's a sign of understanding someone's grief and sorrow and the violence that has been done to him, or her, I'm sorry. And there was a Twitter challenge, a hashtag challenge on Twitter, for women to describe their first unwanted sexual contact. And most women have a story like that, being on the bus and someone putting a hand on their leg, things like that. It's a fact of our lives. A large plurality of women have been raped, and an even larger plurality, if not the majority of women, have experienced unwanted sexual advances or contacts. So that's sweet. It's sweet to love the person and to wish well for the person who's been attacked. But again, it's not enough. So I like this better. I like this better. They describe Shimon and Levi as her brothers. And of course, the question is, you know, she has lots of brothers. Why these two? Why do these two get described as her brothers? Michilta says, she is called by their name. They get connected because they are the only two who risked their lives for her sake. Now, again, I've said, I've been inspired. I thought, what if anyone did anything to my mother or sister? I would murder them. That's not exactly what this is saying. That's saying they risked their lives. It wasn't just about doing violence and retribution. It was about taking a stand. It was about being righteous in a place where there is no man, to quote Pirkei Avot. In a place where no one stands up, it was about standing up. That's not easy. And I think And I made a joke previously about Rex Tillerson. But in an era where we may be entering not just here, but in Europe, I think Angela Merkel is receiving a certain kind of backlash, not so much for being a woman, but for certain stands she's taken. In a place where certain moral assumptions we've made and certain progress we've made, and you know, people can be conservative, people can wish for things that were better in the past. I tend to think things are neither better nor worse in the past, just different ways of manifesting humankind's malice towards humankind, human's basic and baser instincts and id and yetzer hara. But in a time when we see rights eroding, when we see social decencies eroding, when we see the status of women no longer progressing, but perhaps reaching a plateau or an interruption, and the status of migrants and the status of other ethnic groups and religious groups, we'll need to take stands. We'll need to be like Shimon and Levi. We'll need to dare. I mean, Jacob says to them later, you disgraced me because you've made everyone hate me. But that's the risk. That's the risk. You have to stand up for women and for others and risk your life, at least maybe your reputation. Because whatever the future holds, whether we like the current president-elect or not, the future is always full of potential and uncertainty and danger. And at no time in our lives or careers or the political, civic culture can we be lax, can we be lackadaisical, can we be apathetic. You have to take a stand. You have to be ready to stand up against sexual addiction, against impropriety, against violence and rhetoric against others. Every one of us in this room has to be Shimon and Levi.